Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Lily Gorin, and today I'm hosting Aidan Smith, author of Gender, Heteronormativity, and the American Presidency, which was recently published by Routledge Press. This is a fascinating analysis of the way that we understand images and masculinity, especially as it is communicated to us through presidential campaigns and political rhetoric and images. Smith explores the idea of heteronormativity within our implicit and explicit conceptions of the American presidency, thus focusing not only on how masculinity is deployed to create particular images of candidates running for office, but also how femininity is used for both first ladies and for female candidates who must negotiate an even more complicated set of expectations, given our 200-year history with the occupants of the White House and the role of patriarchy in the forms and contours of that office. But I'm going to let Aidan dive into all this as we discuss her new book, Gender, Heteronormativity, and the American Presidency. I would like to welcome Aidan Smith to the New Books in Political Science podcast, and I'd like to ask her to tell us a little bit about herself and how she came to this project.
Well, thank you, Lily, and I'm glad to be able to talk about the book. You know, it's my background is in American studies and mass communications, and I've sort of really always been drawn to thinking about the presidency from a rhetorical point of view. You know, from I remember the presidency or the campaigns of 1984 and being really interested, even as a child, with this representation of the adversarial position between Mondale and Reagan. And when I started thinking about why I was drawn to that, it was because of the sort of narrative representation of these two Democrat, Republican, how are we thinking about them in juxtaposition to one another? And as I approached my studies and really became drawn to gender studies, thinking about how gender is this invisible force that shapes the way that we think about things and shapes the way that we live our day-to-day experience, and how it's never really talked about in terms of how we make decisions about the leader of our nation. And, you know, we certainly saw more of that with Hillary Clinton's campaign in 2008 and 2016, but only in looking at what it meant to have a woman pursuing the presidency in a meaningful and possible way. Rarely did we ever look at what it meant for the men that were pursuing the White House and the way that masculinity either worked for or against them. And again, these sort of what we think of as tropes of appropriate masculinity. The book came about sort of as I was starting working on my dissertation as a graduate student in 2008. I did my PhD at the University of Hawaii, and there was all of this discussion about this guy named Barack Obama that no one had ever heard of.
Who was from Hawaii.
He was from Hawaii, and his mother was an anthropologist, I believe, at the University of Hawaii. And so I remember, I would say it was probably 2006, you know, as Hillary Clinton, before she had declared, but, you know, seemed to be the anointed one, what this would mean. And some colleagues of mine at UH said, well, you know, Obama's going to run. I had no idea who the man was, had never heard of him, much like many folks in the country at that time. And this idea that there was a young African-American, and for us in Hawaii, this Hawaiian born guy who really had the chance to make the presidency. And I'll be honest, at the time I thought there's really no way that that could possibly happen. Hillary Clinton is the next in line, you know, again, the way that many people did think of that. And, you know, we know what became of that. And so that really my position in thinking about gender, in thinking about place and region, and seeing the way that Obama used masculinity and of course the intersecting identity as an African American and as the son of an immigrant, how he was able to use tropes of masculinity to really position himself well. And obviously victoriously throughout the race, not only during the primary, but in his contest with John McCain in the general. And so that's sort of where I came to really be thinking about how he was able to do that. And going back to my childhood sort of interest in these races, not as a political scientist, but as somebody who consumes media and thinking about that. And when I sort of had identified what I was looking for, I began to see it over and over again. And I think it certainly, some of the things that I talk about came about in 2016 as well. So that's the genesis of the project.
Okay. And so I want to ask you, you know, sort of the broad shape of the project. And you know, one of the things that I found really interesting in your writing and in your research, and you know, we're all watching the Olympics now, cheering on various athletes, but I kept sort of cheering on as I was reading your book in a kind of way, like, somebody is actually writing this, somebody is actually talking about this. So please talk to me and our listeners about these kind of expectations that we have that we're not even aware of with regard to who is running for the presidency, how they look, how they act, how they're positioned. And, you know, we expect certain things that we're not even aware that we expect. And that's really what I found your book to highlight, and to sort of get at what we're seeing and what we're consuming and what we understand as a result of that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think it goes back to thinking about gender and that word. We tend to say, okay, now we're talking about women. When we say gender, we're talking about women. But in actuality, what gender is a way of being in the world that is intelligible to the culture that we're within, for both men and women. And, you know, we're now entering a stage where we're talking about non-binary gendered folks, but historically, we're really talking about the way that men should be and the way that women should be, such to the point that it is largely invisible, I think, that we don't need to be told what manhood looks like, and we don't need to be told what womanhood looks like. And so for those candidates vying for the presidency, they have made every effort largely to demonstrate that they conform to the way a man should be. And I think that goes from both successes in business, successes on the military field, successes as a father and as a husband. And you know, yes, there's certainly a physicality to it. We expect our men to be tall and physically attractive, and all of those things that we know smooth the way for individuals pursuing any kind of leadership role, whether in business or on the playing field or in the military, as I said. But so much so that these expectations, I believe, really limit those individuals who would even consider pursuing the office. So if I were to say to a layperson, what does a presidential candidate look like, given the history of the office in the United States, we would certainly use the male pronoun. We would say, well, he probably went to an Ivy League school, and he probably has a wife, and he probably has children, and he probably has a resume that demonstrates success. And that can look like different things, whether or not we're talking about electoral success, you know, those folks who've come up through a governorship or through the Senate, or for instance, Donald Trump, you know, he had never held an elected office, but he has success in the boardroom. He was a television star, right? That there's this idea that he's demonstrated his prowess in his chosen field, And a lot of that gives them the credibility to run. What we see for women pursuing office, of course, is that same level of expectation that she would have had success in her chosen field. When we think about folks like Carly Fiorina or Sarah Palin, of course, vice presidency, but Hillary Clinton as well. Here's some electoral. She was elected senator. She served as Secretary of State. But also demonstrating how she would have conformed to expectations within the family space, where women have been historically placed, given this idea of the separate spheres, that men are expected to be successful outside of the home, women historically expected to be successful within the home in the domestic space. And so so we see our women candidates, you know, demonstrating their credentials in that place as well. Their mothers, their wives. I think what I really want to hope that people take away from the book is these tropes that are so ingrained into our expectations are not natural. They don't just happen. And that, you know, people really, both men and women, when they're running for this office, really need to be able to demonstrate their successes in their appropriate gender performance. Whether or not it's Hillary Clinton talking about being a grandmother as the most important role in her life, or whether or not it's Barack Obama talking about his role as a father, or even going back to Richard Nixon and the Checkers speech and defending his family and their financial assets and his, you know, this idea of him defending some campaign spending as being part of what a father does to protect his family and referring to Pat Nixon's good Republican cloth coat. So I think, you know, these notions and tropes have always been with us. They're so ingrained that we don't see them. And I really want folks to see them. So.
And so my follow-up question to that is, you go through and you explain some of these tropes. And that also gets to your argument with regard to heteronormativity, which I also want to talk about. But you talk about, you know, sort of these military expectations or boardroom expectations, or, you know, the sort of expectations of fatherhood or motherhood. But where did they come from? Because some of what you get into is also like the form of the office itself, and the kind of hallmarks of it that are inevitably going to then possibly push on our expectations in this regard.
Right. So, I mean, I think that we think of the presidency and, you know, we see this sort of synonym as like the commander in chief, right? So, you know, whether or not we're looking at the actual ability of the office, right? That this is the commander in chief of the armed forces and he has the power and the ability to command the military. We also look at those people who've occupied the office, whether or not it was George Washington, this founding father who, you know, was the hero of the American Revolution. We see Ulysses S. Grant come into that space. We see Dwight Eisenhower. We have this idea that a general, who has converted battlefield leadership into political power as the norm, right? This is what it looks like, and this is what we want. Now, we've seen some changes in that in the last 30 years on what that looks like, but we still see those candidates vying for the office based on their military experience, whether or not that be Jimmy Carter as a naval submariner, John Kerry as a Vietnam era veteran, John McCain as a Vietnam veteran, not always successful, certainly, but using this idea that I have the capacity and the credentials to lead this nation because I am a military leader, or because I have I've almost earned that right to pursue this office based on my service to the nation in the armed forces. We know that that's up until very, very recently, women were excluded from battlefield service, although certainly we've had women in the military for decades. But, you know, that sort of claim to the presidency based upon military service has historically been limited to women. And I think that we'll see some shifts now that women have had the opportunity to serve on the battlefield in that space. So that's one way, this idea of the warrior hero laying claim to pursuit of the presidency. Another trope that I identify is this notion of the self-made man, that in addition to battlefield experience and the ability of the president to lead the nation based on his wartime experience, that the self-creation, right, that I've come from nothing, I've used the benefits of this nation to better myself and to both for capital gains as well as, you know, personal character building gains. But that because I've been able to do this, I've brought myself up from nothing, that I know how to lead this nation. This sort of grit and determination has been, is part of my intrinsic character, and I'll bring that to the office. And so I think we see that with Andrew Jackson, you know, this idea of him as Old Hickory, Theodore Roosevelt, who we know was not a self-made man, but sort of presented himself as that with the Rough Riders and his exploits in the South Dakota Badlands, the old, you know, San Juan Hill, even though he was born in a townhouse on the Lower East Side.
Harvard guy.
Yes, yeah, went to Harvard, all of that. Not the Lower East Side, I'm sorry, but in New York City. You know, this idea of Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton, and even most modernly Barack Obama, that I've overcome the challenges of my upbringing. I am the embodiment of the American dream. This is what it looks like. And this is why I have the capacity to take on this role of leader of the nation. We saw that in 2016, Donald Trump, who again, born into wealth, but narratively talks about the fact that he built his real estate empire as a result of a small loan of $1 million from his father. And so, you know, I think we see Trump supporters today even talking about, well, he's going to be a great chief executive because he knows so much about business. He's built all of these things. He's a builder. And so, you know, not to get into too much contemporary commentary, but that's what makes him a viable candidate. And I would argue that's part of how he got to be in the Oval Office today. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I mean, I think that you're leaning into and explaining like the pioneering myth, the creator, which also takes us back to God, the creator, which is something that you also talk about in terms of understanding the way that patriarchy has kind of formed the office itself. And you know, you go back to Filmer and you go back to some of the theorists who talk about executive power and connect it to the patriarchy. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I articulate it as what I think of the beneficent patriarch, right? That we're looking for that father figure, that this rhetoric of a patriarch who will both protect and guide and lead the nation and the citizen children towards redemption and prosperity as a father would a nuclear family. And so, you know, talking about the natural God-given leadership that was instilled within a king, that when we come through the revolution and we come into this space where we're now, we have self-leadership and we have self-governance, that we're still really looking for we're still looking for that father figure. We're still looking for that patriarch. It's not inherited now. The candidates have to vie for it, but they're still demonstrating to us that they are the father figure, and that they're the ones that are best suited to lead us as a nation. And so I think we see some of that rhetoric trickling down a little bit in terms of candidates like Mitt Romney, candidates like George H.W. Bush, who really presents himself as this, as a patriarch of a large family who is representing manhood in a little bit different way, right? So if we think about what masculinity looks like, this is not football field and G.I. Joe masculinity. This is father knows best masculinity, that there's really something intrinsic and inherent to a protective manhood that the nation needs. And so we've seen that both succeed and fail in presidential campaigns. I think Jimmy Carter probably had both successes and failures with that in terms of policy as well as the campaign. But the idea that what we're looking for is the ideal man. And the ideal man looks like different things at different moments, given what we perceive as the needs of the nation, what the electorate perceives as the needs of the nation at that that given time. And so candidates are really sort of trying to figure out how their biography and how their background can fit into that. And what we see is it's certainly not, I guess this is one of my key arguments, is it's not partisan. It's not Republican or Democratic. We don't see this fluidity of trying to fit your biography into one of these tropes as being, well, all Republicans do this or all Democrats do this. That's not my argument at all, is that we see whether it's Bill Clinton trying to convince us that he's a self-made man or Donald Trump that he's a self-made man, it's the same sort of narrative turn in both cases.
Right. And it doesn't necessarily depend on the policy disposition of the individual. It's much more about how we sort of consume them as a person, as opposed to their policy preferences. And so I wanted to ask you a little bit more following along this line of the patriarch and the ideal man, to sort of get into the next section of your analysis, which is this sort of understanding of heteronormativity and how that also is a really key component in shaping what we as consumers and voters, essentially consumers of this office and voters for this office, what we do and don't anticipate or expect with regard to the person running for it or inhabiting it. And so those of us who study gender and sexuality and popular culture use this term a lot, but can you explain to a degree what it means generally, but also more precisely what it means within your exploration of the American presidency?
I hope so. You're right that normally we don't really think about the word heteronormativity, perhaps outside of a gender studies classroom or a space where we're keyed into to think about sexuality as an identifying marker for consideration. So I think heteronormativity is this notion that there's one natural way to be in the world, and that is within a reproductive sexual union between a man and a woman, and to the exclusion of all other kinds of sexuality or participation in the culture. And so, so there's a man and a wife, and they produce the children, and decisions are made with that idealized family unit in mind. Whether or not those are policy decisions, something as simple as linking health insurance to a marital partner, questions about, for my study, obviously, like the First Lady as being a role that is has an administrative capacity, right? That because a woman is married to a man that is elected to office, that she somehow has a role or responsibility within an administration. Even if that role is performative, right? That whether or not it's even,
it's often performative. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, and when it, right, exactly. And when it's not performative, when we see things or, folks like Hillary Clinton who are trying to run the healthcare efforts in 1992, that's somehow, you know, well, she has a role, but not that kind of role, right? Like that's, you know, we want her there, but we really want her doing what we want her to do in terms of femininity and hosting parties and parenting the child of the leader that we've chosen. So again, one of these things that it's so natural that we don't, or it's perceived to be so natural that we don't question it. And the way I'm kind of looking at it is as problematic is that not only does it really proscribe roles for both women and men, and that there are confines of, you know, we must always be perceived to be straight, because that is the non-pathological way to be. But that any gestures that might be outside of that space or nods toward community members and citizens that are not in that space are troubled and troubling. And so I think that there are markers of heteronormativity that we see not only by presenting one's spouse, whether that is a man or a woman, if you're, you know, depending on your identity, but also that children are centered as markers of successful adulthood, frankly, that we look at the Obama children, for instance, as products of a heterosexual union that demonstrate that Barack Obama is a good guy, or that Chelsea Clinton's role as Hillary Clinton's campaign surrogate and as the producer of Hillary Clinton's grandchildren is somehow an indicator that Hillary Clinton will be a good leader. And I think that's, you know, it becomes problematic when we think about what those individuals that excludes, right? So, you know, I mean, I think as I sort of get to in the conclusion, and I think much more work needs to be done, but, you know, we haven't really seen, gay marriage has been legal for a very short period of time. So, and we certainly haven't had any candidates for presidency that are out, that identify as homosexual publicly, that that have pushed against this trope. But it's almost anathema to think that there would be a queer candidate, right? When we know that there's so much that's invested in this public performance of the nuclear family. So, you know, I do remember both in 2008 and 2016 when I was talking with folks about my work and people would say, so if Hillary Clinton wins, what will we call Bill? You know, what will we call him? And I said, well, you'll call him Mr.
That's
President.
What his name was before.
that's what his official title would be. But so troubling was this idea that we would have an inversion, right? That would he be the first gentleman? Would he be Mr. Clinton, or this idea that we really struggle with a way to think about this? And they're just married people, right? They're married people who one of them has this job that's very important, but the notion that when candidates run, that their spouse and the gender performance of that spouse is also being interrogated by the electorate. And for good or for bad, I mean, I think much work has been done on what an asset Michelle Obama was, for instance. Some folks spent a lot of time talking about what a liability Melania Trump was or potentially could have been for Donald Trump. But there, rare is the question or rare is the consideration that we should care what these people's partners do for or did for a living or any of this. So I think it's one of those so naturalized that we don't see it anymore.
And that's really a lot of what I keep thinking about in reading your book, was that, you know, you are interrogating these expectations that we all have, but that we don't pay any attention to. And that's why I think that the particularly your assessment and analysis of heteronormativity, the role of the family, how the family is projected and presented, the role of the children, even again, if they are not adults yet. And then we have the recent campaign with Chelsea Clinton and Ivanka Trump occupying this very important space as surrogates for their parents who are running for the presidency. But what is that telling us? As you say, we don't pay any attention to the fact that this is telling us something about our expectations with regard to the procreation capacities of the folks who are running for president.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's, we do see it, you know, this idea that if a candidate doesn't have children, there needs to be a reason why, you know, that somehow needs to be addressed. I mean, I think even one of the moments during the 2016 campaign, that struck me the most was during, I think it was the second debate between, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And it was really at one of the high points of contention after the Access Hollywood video and all of these other things, when, the moderator asked the candidates to say something nice about their opponent. And Hillary says, well, you know, I just, he's got these great children. He really has these, you know, I don't remember exactly, but something about how wonderful Ivanka and the sons were. And, you know, it's, they do it themselves, right? Like they understand the value rhetorically, of acknowledging that these children are they're clean and tidy and performing their positions professionally and all of these things, and that somehow that functions as an asset for the parent. And again, really trying to sort of center who does this exclude? And why is it important that these candidates, again, both Republican and Democrat, that they be the ideal parents? When we're not, that's not necessarily what we're electing them to be. We're not necessarily choosing them based on whether or not they have four children or two, or perhaps we shouldn't. But also thinking about like how this, the need to continually present yourself as a parent could impact policy choices. And, you know, if we have, we saw this frequently with Barack Obama, saying, you know, as a parent of two girls, I'm concerned about having, for instance, I'm concerned about over-the-counter access to the morning after pill. And there, he did get some pushback from that. And, you know, I believe the policy changed, that eventually that was shifted a bit. Or immediately after the Sandy Hook shooting in 2012, you know, that very memorable moment when, President Obama is standing at the lectern and talking about the fact that as a parent, he can't imagine what the nation is going through and what the families of these, of those 20, I believe 20 children, were going through. We want to see, we want to see someone that looks like us and that feels like us about these issues. Or it would seem to be the case that that's what we want. But I wonder sometimes how that need to occupy a space, doesn't bring that need for a candidate to occupy the space as a parent excludes some, and perhaps the performance of that parenthood shapes policy choices down the way.
And I thought, you know, I think that you're accurate in understanding that as well, because I think you're right in casting a lot of the role, the sort of symbolic role of the office is this father or mother, maybe, but certainly father. George Washington is the father of our country. And so that a lot of, you know, what we understand then of the person in the office comes from our expectations with regard to what we expect from somebody who is acting as a patriarch. Which brings me to my next question a bit in terms of this conception of masculinity and manliness, which you are also sort of trying to unpack in terms of our understanding of what we're projecting onto the office. But you say, as you note, you know, we often say gender and then that means women. But I want to know what you mean about, or what you're sort of talking about in the book in terms of how female candidates for president and other executive officers like governors, where we've had far fewer women than we have in Senate or the House or in legislative bodies or on the judiciary bench, how do women candidates sort of negotiate these conceptions and expectations?
Yeah, I mean, there's many scholars have written about what we think of as the double bind and how women are simultaneously expected to display these attributes of leadership, which we tend to think of as masculine, right? That there's aggression, there's decisiveness, there's analytical approaches, as opposed to what we tend to think of as being feminine, which is compassion, collaboration, sensitivity to children and to the otherwise disadvantaged. So women candidates really need to navigate this terrain of having all of these leadership characteristics like decisiveness, like aggression, like analytical approaches within a feminine frame. And so when we think about, a lot of time we spend talking about Hillary Clinton, but, you know, we can look at models like Sarah Palin and Geraldine Ferraro, who were, of course, vying for the vice presidency, but that they really use their motherhood and their maternity and their performance of those roles as demonstrations of their ability to possibly lead the nation, maybe one heartbeat away from the presidency. And so we see, you know, in 2008, when Sarah Palin sort of comes out of nowhere as the former governor of Alaska, that she has her children on display both at the convention and on the campaign, and, you know, really uses this, her role as the mother of a child with special needs as a benefit to her, right? That she says that there you will have the children, families with children with special needs will have an ally in the White House, that there will be someone who understands, that there is someone who is embodying this role of sort of, the hockey mom, the pit bull with lipstick, this idea that she's aggressive but still feminine. And it's because she's advocating for her children. And she makes this claim that first she started out as the PTA president, then she became the mayor of Wasilla, Alaska, and then goes on to the governorship. But it's all tempered within this narrative of wanting something better for her children. And again, Sarah Palin, obviously a Republican, still faces this challenge of, okay, well, here's the way that you're performing your leadership within an appropriate space, an appropriate feminized space. And yet we see much criticism of her coming from media outlets as well as other commentators about, you know, well, you have five children and one of them is a newborn with special needs. Are you sure you should be running for office? Are you sure that this is what you should be doing at this time? And given my research, Barack Obama had children at that point. I believe the girls were 10 and 7 or 8. No one questioned whether or not Barack Obama should be running for office given the youth of his children. There was not one claim on whether or not it was an appropriate time in his family life to be pursuing the office of the presidency. And so we see that's a very minor example, but really some of these challenges that if women are pursuing higher office and pursuing these sort of non-traditional leadership roles, that they're called upon to answer how it will impact their nuclear family in ways that male candidates are not called on to answer. And so, I mean, I think that it's, this is the other thing I get into a little bit, is the idea of Hillary Clinton really being viable as a candidate at, with now that her children are adults. It's difficult for me to imagine what a more youthful woman would look like in terms of having young children while she's pursuing the presidency.
And I think there have been some studies about the fact that women often enter electoral politics after their children are a certain age, in part because of some of these sort of unconscious expectations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, Nancy Pelosi is one, you know, I believe she's the mother of four or five, and went into the office and, you know, still all sorts of complications in terms of talking about candidates and age. That's another book, I think. But exactly. So we see those challenges in ways that male candidates simply are not questioned
about. And it certainly goes to what we expect, but we don't really understand that we're expecting it. And so you talk a bit about in the book about this role of military service. And we, you know, you've mentioned also the generals from Washington to Grant to Eisenhower, and also people like Teddy Roosevelt and the Rough Riders, and Jimmy Carter and John Kerry's military experience. And towards the end of the book, in the conclusion, you talk about sort of the decline of the requirement to some degree, the expected requirement that you have had military service. The vast majority of our elected presidents have had some sort of military experience. And I guess one of my questions for you is, why is this part really a big part of our understanding of the presidency? But also, you know, we sort of now are going to have, we are having a generation of veterans from our longest war in Afghanistan, in Iraq, both of which are slightly less controversial than Vietnam was, at least towards the end of Vietnam. And how do those figure into sort of some of our expectations? And of course, I'm thinking about an image I saw recently of Tammy Duckworth, who is of a combat veteran, who is disabled in combat and is now pregnant. So she's like crossing all kinds of boxes in opposite directions in lots of ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are a couple of things that are just generational. One, that, you know, we're still dealing with baby boomer candidates for president, and those folks were subject to the draft, and we don't have conscripted service anymore, and so I think that sort of shapes the way that we think about those younger veterans who volunteered. A lot of the critique of people like Bill Clinton, people like Donald Trump, are that they, and George W. Bush as well, is that not only did they not serve, but that they somehow avoided service by potentially unethical means. So we saw that Bill Clinton had some educational deferments, that we saw George W. Bush, I believe it was the Texas Air National Guard. And then Donald Trump, who, you know, I think now, you know, with his five deferments for bone spurs, right, that there were these manipulations and sort of ducking of responsibility that we saw folks like John Kerry and John McCain try and leverage up and say, well, look, I volunteered, I served, this is what I did. John Kerry, of course, who becomes an anti-war advocate or activist on his return from service in Vietnam. But this, and Al Gore, you know, I think, who served as well, but didn't really seem to try and, didn't make use of that in ways I think he could have in 2000. But I think it's a different dichotomy between those who served as a volunteer versus those who maybe were a little bit smarmy because they tried to duck it in different ways. Or at least, again, that was sort of the opposition narrative that, you know, Bill Clinton was not only did he not serve, but that there's this accusation of cowardice for trying to get out of it. Whereas contemporary veterans are, you know, those of these are people who volunteered. they served with differing levels of distinction. I think that that rhetoric is going to change a little bit, just given some of those generational differences or historical differences in how people came to military service in the first place. I also think that military service looks a bit different now, given technological advances. In that, you know, when we were talking about sending troops over in 1967, 68, 69, these were boots on the ground. And, you know, it was a very different level of engagement than piloting a drone or piloting a helicopter. Not to comment on any difference in service, but I think it was I think that it's a different imaginary for the electorate to consider what that looks like. I also think, and I don't have the statistics at hand, but because at this point in time, we know that fewer people serve now than did previously, even post 9/11, that I just think that there are fewer individuals grow up knowing someone who served. And so the idea that it's a requirement, if you don't know anyone who served in any of the armed forces, it is less intelligible and less perhaps less admirable, right? So I think that's a different space. I should sort of say I grew up in a military family and grew up around military bases, and everyone I knew served, and the idea that that people didn't was anathema until I got to my small liberal arts college and realized that other people didn't have that experience. And so I think that sort of shifts the way that we think. I certainly wouldn't speculate on what that means for candidates coming up in 2020 or in 2024, when we have a real group of service members who are vying for political office and veterans. And, you know, I'll be honest, I really thought that Trump's bone spur deferments would be a larger issue in this campaign, and they were not, or seemed to not. So, so I'm not quite sure, honestly, what all of that will come to. But I do think that there is a difference. There's a discernible difference between conscription and service, and or the avoidance of service, and a volunteer force.
And I think you're right that the fact that many Americans do not necessarily personally know somebody who has served in combat is probably a factor as well, because it's much more of an abstraction for many people as a result. I mean, your components for understanding sort of gender and heteronormativity are still, though, this kind of business success or electoral success, the father component, and some sort of service, which may also be public service. And so it may not be strictly military service. But again, I think you're right to sort of, who are we going to see running for office in 2020, 2024, as we have potentially more veterans coming into political life and public life and running for office as well, both men and women, which is, you know, part of the dynamic that I think is shifting a bit as well.
Yeah. And I mean, I just want to sort of add on to that and say, you know, it's military service is not enough and has never been enough on its face to get someone elected. One of the chapters in the book looks at the 1952 and 1956 candidacies of Eisenhower and Adlai Stevenson. And even in 1952, with Eisenhower being the most respected man in the United States, according to Gallup polls and whatnot, because of his role as the supreme leader in Europe during World War II, he still brings out Mamie Eisenhower and talks about, you know, the fact that Mamie can't afford groceries at the store because of inflation. And, you know, that's he really, that era in 1952 is sort of the introduction of the television in ubiquity into American homes. And he launches the Eisenhower Answers America campaign that allows him to address these domestic issues like Social Security, like inflation, like veterans benefits for those returning servicemen. And so he understood, and his candidacy, his campaign understood as well, that just beating the Nazis wasn't enough, even for Dwight Eisenhower, that there still needed to be some engagement with the domestic space.
And it was only enough for George Washington to have won the Revolutionary War to get him elected president, but he did have to preside over the Constitutional Convention. Right. So, but I wanted to ask you a bit about, you know, what you do in the context of this book, as you just brought up the chapter on Eisenhower and Stevenson. But, you know, through the structure of this book and through your study, you're looking at the introduction also of these kind of visual images, and how that is also contributing to our expectations, if you will. Can you take us through sort of some of the examples you use in the book in terms of the shifts within the media itself and how that also is playing into what our expectations are for the American presidency?
Sure. So I was trained as a mass communications scholar before I sort of branched into American studies and gender studies. And so thinking about audience analysis is really important, and as well as technological interventions that change over time. So as I mentioned, in 1952, we really see the ubiquity of television in the home. You know, I think it was like 90% of American homes owned a set by, I'm going to say, 1956, 57. And so that really shifts the way that political messages are shared with the electorate. Now not only do we have the voices that were coming through the radio in the FDR era and Truman, but we see now that we actually need to be able to look at the candidate. And so much has been written about things like the 1960 debate between Nixon and Kennedy, and those folks who listened on the radio thought that Nixon won, and the people who watched on TV thought that Kennedy won. But I think that it really also, there's something a little bit more sophisticated going on in terms of not only the way that we consume the visual images versus the auditory messages, but the fact that these messages are in the domestic space. And so when we think about a television in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, this is an instrument of communication that is in your home, in what we call the family room, where folks gather around to watch the glowing images and be entertained for the evening. And I think that that has certainly changed in the last 10, 15 years with the advent of mobile devices and now your communications are in your pocket all the time. And I think there's a lot of work to be done in that space. But for the era I'm looking at, it really is important and shouldn't be neglected that these are communications that are happening in the home. And so particularly in the 1950s and 60s with this suburban domesticity that has been well researched and talked about by folks like Elaine Tyler May, and this investment in the home as a safe space in light of international fears and idea about the Soviet Union and nuclear annihilation and all of that, that candidates are creating communications that are coming in these 30 and 60 seconds encapsulations with jingles, with illustrations, with photos of themselves and their wives and their children, and that they're packaging those communications in much the same way that we see other commodities packaged, right? So whether or not it's a box of cornflakes or an Eisenhower Answers America spot, perhaps they have some similarities in ways that they might not have had previously. And so so the book really, I look at several key, or what I've identified as key elections, particularly, as I said, 1952, 1956 with this advent of the televisual campaign, this 1960 election between Nixon and Kennedy, which we know is very close and which we know Kennedy won, obviously. But that some of those same tropes are being used in terms of television as a way to represent gender performance, that we see Jackie Kennedy being used in campaign commercials in ways that Mamie Eisenhower was not. Adlai Stevenson was a divorced man and didn't have a wife, but he did have a daughter-in-law, who performed some of those functions. All the way, so I look at that a little bit in terms of the way that the First Lady sort of emerges in that era in a different space. In the 1980 election, we see Nancy Reagan taking a role as a very vocal advocate for her husband and sort of defending him in different ways in television spaces. And some of the more packaged things that we think of in 1984, again, a lot of work has been done on looking at the Morning in America spot. But I do look a little bit more specifically at some of the gender communications that are happening there. Why is it that the white wedding is so important and emblematic of what we think of Morning in America looking like in 1984? So, you know, it does change and shift in 2008 with social media, with mobile devices. And I think there's a lot more work to be done with how some of the same tropes have shifted, given the shift in how communications happen. But television is still with us.
hasn't gone anywhere.
Yes, we just consume it a little bit differently now than we did in 1956. So,
some of the points that you've made is that there's a lot of area that continues to need research that hasn't been explored as substantively as is necessary. So then my question to you is, what are you working on now? Is it a continuation of this in a different direction?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're still really reckoning with the Twitter presidency. And, you know, I think there's a lot of content analysis to be done in terms of President Trump's use of Twitter as a, you know, what can be done in 140 characters or now 280 characters that sometimes is televisual and sometimes not. But at the very bottom is text. And what mass media outlets, televisual outlets like CNN and MSNBC and Fox News do with those tweets, right? So he really doesn't have to spend very much time at all in terms of production. He lets the media outlets do that for him. So I think there's some content analysis to be done. I'm still sort of thinking about methods and how to go about that. But what I'm really focusing on right now is the role of Ivanka Trump. In terms of offering us up some of the same rhetorical functionality as a first lady, given her stepmother's limitations, both as the third wife, which is a new thing that we're thinking about. There hasn't been a third wife before, and it's been a very long time since we've had foreign-born First Lady. But what's interesting to me is Ivanka's role symbolically, rhetorically as the First Lady, as this very traditionally beautiful and feminine factor in her father's administration, and how she's deployed strategically at times to demonstrate that her father is not a misogynist. That he is not an anti-Semite, and that he is this beneficent patriarch, given the success of both Ivanka and her brothers, and she does have a sister as well, though Tiffany Trump has been relatively silent, obscure at this point. But I think, you know, that she is within the administration. She's an advisor. Her husband is an advisor on things as important as Middle East peace negotiations. And I think that this is this is unprecedented in terms of the daughter of a president. So
yeah, it's certainly different from Robert Kennedy as the Attorney General. And I think you're right, because Melania is not occupying the usual space.
Right. I mean, and you know, I mean, it's so interesting because things change on the daily, really, with talking about this marriage. But, you know, we saw a first lady who was reluctant to move into the White House, didn't come in with her son, her young son, until about 6 months into his term, who has had limited success with the platforms that she's offered up in terms of the cyberbullying and really just lots of demonstrated reluctance to perform that role, that ceremonial role as first lady. So Ivanka has been present. And again, I think a lot of this is complicated by the fact that Trump's television show, The Apprentice, which got him the most notoriety, given his, you know, 40 years of public life. But Ivanka had a role in that television production as, you know, sort of her father's right-hand person within the Trump organization. And so we just sort of see some of that happening now, but in the presidency. And I think I'm looking at that, and I would love to have a conclusion about what I find, but I think it's clear that there are differences given past administrations. I think we have yet to see what the policy ramifications of some of those differences are, but I feel that they will be apparent.
Well, I hope that when you finish your work on it, you will come back on the New Books podcast and talk to us about it.
I would love to.
All right. And so my final question for you, where can an interested listener, now reader, buy a copy of Gender, Heteronormativity, and the American Presidency that's been published by Routledge Press?
It would be great for them to check out the Routledge website. It's available now. And, you know, I am hoping to be at APSA, NWSA, the National Women's Studies Association, as well as the American Studies Association, and the book will be available in those places as well. But so, yeah.
Super. Well, I will certainly direct people at the APSA towards it in the book room. Aidan Smith, thanks so much for being on the New Books in Political Science podcast today. I'm so glad you could join me.
Thank you, Lily.
It's my pleasure.